Welcome to a new episode of Whiplash Agile, where we focus on the failures that are necessary to be successful on an agile journey, because there are always valuable lessons to be learned from someone else's struggles and stumbles. I'm Jeff Anderson, your host and CEO of Agile by Design. Okay, welcome everybody to the next episode of Whiplash Agile. Today, I'm super excited to have Heidi Helfland here. Welcome aboard, Heidi. By way of introduction, I came across Heidi because of her amazing book, Dynamic Reteaming. I think this is a text that's essential for any organization that wants to adapt and thrive in turbulent times. And that's the only constant, right? Turbulent times. Heidi also shares her insight as, you know, an international keynote speaker at various global conferences and events. Heidi is an author, obviously, of Dynamic Reteaming, but she's also both an agile coach and a leadership coach. Her mission in life, I'm going to paraphrase here, is to empower teams and organizations to build strong relationships, collaborate effectively, and create inclusive cultures, all in the name of innovation and growth. Welcome aboard, Heidi.
Thanks, Jeff. Great to be here.
At a high level, you wrote a book a few years back called Dynamic Reteaming. At the highest level, could you describe to our readers what exactly is dynamic reteaming and why do you think it's so powerful for people to consider or for organizations to consider?
Yeah, dynamic reteaming is essentially team change. As our people and software teams, as time continues on, we're going to experience changes in our environments and to our teams. These changes happen according to different patterns that I discovered when I was writing the book, Dynamic Reteaming. And essentially, the essence of dynamic reteaming is just the concept of team change. However, I've come to experience it as you're working in a software company and there are different team changes around you, usually more than one type. And I consider that the dynamic aspect of dynamic reteaming.
You say, one of the quotes, I'm not going to get it perfectly, but I'm going to do it best. Like it or not, your teams are going to change. And sometimes that change comes from us and sometimes that comes from outside forces. So you just talked about that sort of evolution of teams and these patterns of change. So I don't know if you could explain that sort of team life cycle that I think is quite powerful and maybe even some of the pitfalls that you see teams often fall through as they go through that life cycle.
Yeah. So life cycle of teams, I like the metaphor of an eco cycle, which I learned about from the Liberating Structures community and from a book called Panarchy that I reference in my book. And essentially, a team comes together and forms, like it's in a birth phase. It could continue on and grow and grow and grow, maybe through adolescence to become like a team that's in a maturity phase. And maybe then sometimes something happens, a team member leaves, it's essentially a creative destruction. And then you're back into the team again is different than it was before. So that
you're like the phoenix rising from the ashes.
Yeah, and I'm kind of like using my hand here to show like an infinity symbol. But essentially, you know, a group of people will come together and work on something together. It's like a joint project, let's say, joint area of work. And people come, people go. Just through the passage of time, our teams evolve and change. They don't always stay the same composition. Maybe the team is the first one at a startup and they get a round of funding and then they hire 10 people. Well, what are you going to do there? There's some changes that will happen to the teams. So I think, and there's different agents or different people that are involved in this situation, right? We might leave our company and it's our decision. Someone else might join and maybe we have the ability to interview and help select the next person that comes, or maybe not. Other forces at play happen, you know, that we've seen a lot of stories of teams shrinking or people leaving companies, many of them getting laid off, right? That's kind of, you know, maybe we didn't want that to happen. And it's like a force outside of our control that impacts our teams. So we have this notion of team of people working together on a joint effort, collaborating in different ways, or maybe not so much, you know, it depends. But then through the passage of time, situations happen, and whether we like it or not, it's not always going to be those same people together.
What are the two traps that you talked about? You, like throughout this life cycle. There's two kind of very distinctive traps that you talked about.
Yeah. So in that life cycle, that eco cycle, so let's say the team forms and it's a startup, and then maybe the startup doesn't find product market fit or people aren't buying it. You know, it happened at a startup that I was a part of, and that initial first team went through a transition or transformation. It went through, in the model I write about in the book, they call it like a poverty trap in some of the literature. So like a failure to thrive. If you ever get a team together and maybe they don't get along or it's just not working out, maybe the team gets disbanded or changes, and it could be like kind of stuck in this poverty trap.
I actually thought the poverty trap was like, I'm thinking, because I do a lot of big enterprise work, and I was like, oh, the poverty trap, they don't actually have access to any of the back end capabilities that they need, or finance isn't at the table, or their stakeholders aren't there. I love that poverty trap, because I feel like there's so many times teams come up and they feel like they just don't have what they need to be successful, or maybe they're doing the wrong thing or a whole bunch of things. I thought that was an awesome one.
Yeah, I'm sure it could be like that too. And that's something that really hinders them or holds them back from, you know, being a real like successful team.
And then you had the other trap, which was, what was that one again?
Yeah. So then there's the rigidity trap.
That's
right. So if we think about our infinity symbol or this eco cycle, let's say your team is together and it's going pretty well. You're thriving. Maybe you're delivering software to your customers and it's at a cadence that everybody loves. And maybe at some point, that maybe the team grows bigger and it's sort of like it's harder to make decisions or the work is diverging because there's so many more people. You don't really feel the need to pay attention to what someone is saying in the stand-up anymore because they're working on something completely different and it's kind of distracting to you. Meetings take longer, work diverges. It's harder to make decisions. Let's say you're planning out a new area of your software and now you have like these 20 people on the team or 15 people, who do you invite to that meeting to make decisions? Things get awkward. So it's kind of like a rigidity trap. You might be feeling stuck or things just aren't moving and like something different needs to happen in order for us to feel productive again. And some points in that example, I was illustrating like a grow and split. Sometimes teams come to the decision themselves or with input from others that maybe it would work better for everyone if they were split into two or more teams.
Right. I mean, I've actually encountered a lot of this in organizations, especially organizations going through like these big agile transformations where they create a whole bunch of teams and then, you know, they do it a little bit more upfront or a lot more upfront than they should. And so they've went from 8 departments to 30 teams and now none of the work fits any of the teams, but they stay static because you got to keep the team stable and got to keep them the way they were because the team is sacrosanct. So I was wondering if you had encountered that as well, like some of the things you're saying could almost be called heresy from some of the circles of, I don't want to say agile dogma, but I'll say it, sort of agile dogma in other places, that, you know, like the teams have to be stable, they have to be long-lived, they have to be, you know, kind of flat. And what would you say is a counter to some of those people, basically?
Yeah, so I always like to, you know, the forming, storming, norming, performing, Tuchman's model, for group development is like super catchy, and it was designed to be super catchy. Like he even stated that, you know, it's nice to have something that rhymes. It withstands the test of time. And I think, oh, that's so cool, right? Like that would be great if it was reality. But like a lot of the times, again, people come and go. Our entities move and change. And so that's one.
And some teams gel right away and some teams just never gel.
Yeah, so well, there's yeah. that. So were you going to keep them together if they're all like not getting along and not producing anything? No, you need right. to like break them up. So, you know, there's like certain, I guess there's no absolutes in anything, but if you've ever worked somewhere and you felt really bored because you're with the same people all the time, you might feel like your career is stagnating and you need a change. Like, and so I think sometimes it's, and also the thing is you can't, it would be great if that, even in the Tuchman model sense, forming, storming, norming, performing, that if it was just time that would allow us to become a high performing team. It would be great if it was that easy, but in my career, I guess it spans now it could even be 25 years. It's so long, I'm losing count.
I'm right there with you.
I haven't counted lately, but it's more than 20. You know, it could be that, like, I mean, things just change is the norm, not so much, you know, being static. Now, you know, the word static versus the word stability is something else. Like, you know, to have a semblance of a company where maybe you have some people that are there and then other people change. I think that's a lot of the norm. We kind of continue on and it's moving and changing, but maybe there's a nucleus that's stable. I've experienced that. Sometimes, though, complete teams need to be just disbanded if there's a lot of toxicity. And I think it's sometimes an anti-pattern to keep a toxic team together. When I was working with one once, and I remember the product manager was afraid of the developers, and the whole situation there just was not working. And we just had to make some changes and change the dynamic there. So you can shift that. So dynamic, right? The people together and how they work and the vibe and the groove. And sometimes these things are hard to quantify, but different unique people coming together, sometimes it can work out really well. Other times, you know, maybe it can fall flat and you want to deliberately try to shift the dynamic.
I love the, this is something I wrote about in my book too, which is the core nucleus of an agile, I should stop using the word agile, but an organization striving to increase their agility isn't actually a team. It's the act of two people teaming, whether they're pairing or in a group of three people. And that's going to always be somewhat fluid, no matter what sort of structure you put in place. The counter is, is the human factor. You talk a lot about the human factors in your book, as well as some practices that people can do. I guess I have two questions here. Why do you think so many, maybe you don't think this, would you agree that a lot of organizations struggle with these kind of human factors of reteaming? And if you do, what are some easy things that organizations could do if they want to get better at it?
Yeah. So I think about this in layers. We have these complex socio-technical organizations. There's a human layer. We have a layer with product and delivery. We have the code and the system layer. I like to think of these layers and they're all interconnected, right? Sometimes you shift the team and it impacts other layers. Maybe things take longer or shorter, or maybe the organization of your code changes, right? With the Conway's law, inverse Conway.
Or I was thinking of Conway's law.
Conway's law and the inverse, right? So sometimes people like to try to shift the teams to shift the stuff underneath. Yeah, so it's really all connected. You know, at the heart of it, though, even if something looks good on paper, we're organized like this today, we want to shift into this new structure later, we're dealing with humans and we have thoughts and feelings and we like to be a part of things. And so I think to answer your question, reteaming is about the human layer and the, you know, mostly this is where I focus in the book. And I think, number one, if you include people in shaping the next step, that's a quote from Keith McCandless, Liberating Structures. I don't remember where he said it, but I think about it. Actually, I think about it daily.
I need to read this Liberating Structures.
As nerdy as I am.
Yeah.
Include the people in shaping the next step. People don't
Simple
have
advice.
To make all the decisions. Yeah. It's inappropriate for everybody to make all the decisions all the time. But if we can give input to things that impact our day-to-day, that can be really powerful because maybe we feel more ownership over the future structure and what it looks like. Maybe we're allowed to give some input. Maybe decisions that are close to the team or, you know, right in our sphere, if we have a retrospective and as we're talking about how do we improve the way that we're working together, if we're allowed to change the composition of our teams or to suggest a change, we could feel like we have a little bit more, control over our local environment. And I think it could the people that are doing the work are closest to the work, and to enable the ability to shape our surroundings can help us feel better. I think it can increase our engagement as well.
You talk a little bit about these levels of freedom when it comes to team assignment. It kind of is like the big boss does it all the way to self-selection. And so can you explore that a little bit more? Like, I work for like a lot of people listening, not everybody, but I assume a lot of people are listening because they're somewhat related to the work that my coaches have done. They're all kind of like larger scale, sort of more conservative banks, public sector, that kind of thing. And this idea of self-selection is super alien to them. And I'd love if you maybe explain that concept and maybe some examples, because I feel like some of them want to dip their toes in, but they're probably not sure how to do it or if this is a safe thing to do.
So it's interesting, right? So how do you get on a team? And do you get to have input into that decision making? So when I was thinking about this, you know, so when I wrote this book, I was reflecting on my experience working at several fast-growing startups. Software as a service is my background. So from like 10 people to 800, from 15 people to 900, from 400 to 3,000.
So big, massive growth, right?
Yeah. So like I've experienced a lot of growth in my career, and I'm currently I have a client at a startup now, so I'm back in the case of 10 people, which is really fun. But so the question is, how do we get on our teams, right? So if we have 25 teams, new people come in, how do they get assigned to teams is one question. Or if I want to change teams, how can I do that? How do they form in the first place and all of that? So there's a scale of freedom in the book, from less freedom to more freedom. So like someone at the top puts you on a team, or maybe a manager puts you on a team without your input. Maybe a manager included you and got your input before placing you in a new team assignment. Maybe there's maybe managers and others arrange these self-selection events where people come together and they're able to choose or give input on like the top three choices of which team they would like to join. Or it could be people trade places in teams and then inform the managers.
You've got a graduating scale, right? So it's not about like command and control to anarchy. You're saying, hey, we can give a little bit of trust and a little bit of capability and manage the increase in people's ability to self-select over time, basically.
Yeah. And like the most is that people just go and form teams. And some people do that, you know, maybe it's not their home team, but they form other teams to work on other issues. But yeah, for like a self-selection event, an interesting guest for your podcast would be Chris Smith from Redgate Software in Cambridge, UK. I write about him in the second edition of Dynamic Reteaming. There's an appendix that talks about, gives some tips on how to run a self-selection event where the people are able to give preference in which team they join. So what from interviewing Chris and what Chris talks about, one of the things that they do is they have an annual reteaming event at Redgate, and they've done this for different years, a number of years. So they'll have their And you know, Chris can explain this, but my interpretation is they come up with new areas of work to focus on for the time period coming ahead. They all come together. Different team representatives make posters. This is our team.
This is our mission. This is our outcome. All that kind of good stuff.
All that kind of good stuff. These are the kind of roles we're looking for on our team. And through a facilitated event, the people get to say, these are the preferences that I have, I don't know, first, second, and third. And then through a process that they've developed, the team assignments are made. And there's a book called Creating Great Teams by Sandy Mamoli and David Moll. They're working on an update to that book as well right now. I'm looking forward to that. They go through step-by-step how to run events like this and how to do it. You can also probably do it. You can do it with the online whiteboards as well, I'm sure. But yeah, the idea and what Sandy and David say in their book, and I think it's one of the last phrases in their book is, what would you do if you weren't afraid? She talks about the experience at TradeMe, New Zealand company for buying and selling, I think like a marketplace. And when she was engaged with them and they had to do some sort of reorg, and they decided to create a structure to enable people to give to say their choice. And it takes courage to do something different, right?
Right.
And Yeah. So I thought that was very striking. And
what would you do if you weren't afraid?
What would you do if you weren't afraid? You think, there's a lot of fear with this stuff.
Do you think that line is addressed at the leadership or the team members or both, basically?
I would think both.
Yeah.
You know, leaders who are responsible for organizations you have a lot of pressure to get it right. And so, oh my God, what's going to happen if we don't make all the decisions, if we don't control every little aspect? I think there's, because you want to keep your job. There's not that many of them and you want it to go well. And I think we get used to doing things the same way or traditionally. But what if we could enable people to have a say and make some choices? And
how big was that organization, that reteaming event? Like, do you know, are we talking dozens of people, hundreds of people, thousands of people?
Well, with Redgate, I don't know. I think it's more, I would say both of them, I would guess that, I mean, it's not thousands. I would guess I like to talk about Dunbar groups, Dunbar's number, like, you need a smaller kind of manageable area.
Like the 550, 150, you know?
Yeah. I would say like 200 or less would be manageable for this.
So within that, just over that 150 group. Yeah.
But I don't know. That's a good question. I might have indicated in there.
But even a lot of these larger organizations, they tend to be broken up into groups of a couple of hundred. Like even if you go to like a massive bank or massive retail organization or whatever, it's not like it's one 88,000 person organization running around. They've got these lines of business and departments that tend to be more outcome oriented than functionally oriented. So you can almost think of them as mini businesses. So that scale of being able to manage that 100 to 200 level mark with a big event is actually, I think, quite compelling for, I'm always trying to translate this back to the enterprise space. So in that space, it's very compelling, you know?
And for example, when I was at Procore Technologies, I was involved in a reteaming event and there were probably 80 people total involved in the event. And we had a couple of, like teams of teams, we called them divisions that needed to break into three. There were two divisions we needed to hire. We needed to create more teams and build more of our features that we were building. And we talked about like, well, how are we going to do this? What are the different ways? And what we wound up doing was more of a whiteboard reteaming that I also write about in the book. So it wasn't a live event where people were milling around looking at which opportunity, but a small group of directors got together to come up with a solution to meet the problems that we were facing. I think a lot of, you know, a great way to approach any kind of team change is like, this is a problem. These are possible solutions. So we came up with a solution. I was part of that group and we visualized it on whiteboards, kind of like this one. It's a whiteboard with wheels and we drew the future state, and the future state had some of the same teams and it had some new teams. And we put everyone's name on this board. We had three boards for this one. And we put blank lines for the new people we were hiring and the new roles. And we made an FAQ. We had this whole thing. I write about it in the book, but we weren't comfortable. So we liked this because it had a design solution, and we learned when we got input from the people on the teams that we got some of the.
Now it's on the whiteboard and has wheels and people can see it. And so you got feedback from people. Yeah.
They can see it. And we invited them over. We had sessions by it. We had an FAQ. If you're interested in changing teams, this is how you do it. This is who you talk with. But we learned that like this team should really be over in that other division. And here's why. Like we learned that we got some of the design wrong. And I loved that because, you know, we were more comfortable with the final solution after because we got this input.
And you didn't necessarily, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater and go completely self-selecting. You did have some select, like quote unquote leadership, you know, and even probably positional leadership, design something and then give it out to folks and give them, but they still got to bounce some ideas off of it. Yeah.
Yeah. We iterated with them. And later on at Procore, we got even better with decision making. We had a chief people officer that came aboard named Pat Waters, and she rolled out a decision making framework that she had created with her team that the acronym is RIDE. So for decisions like that, let's say, R-I-D-E-R, who is the requester of the change? In this case, it was a group of engineering directors. I, who can give input on the change? Here it was all the people. It was the 80 people plus we, anybody who came, we were like 350 in our tech org, anyone who could walk over, you know, we were open to input. D, who is the decider of the change? So we put a name, right? Our CTO, so this let's say. It would be the CTO.
Yeah, yeah, the ultimate kind of decision maker.
Yeah, and then E, who's going to execute on this change? Who's going to carry out the changes? When you make changes with large groups, at least, and even teams that split, it's nice to have a timeline. Sometimes if you have a physical organization, you need to talk to IT. You need to talk to facilities because maybe the desks are going to move or the equipment needs to move. So who's going to roll out and execute on the change? And we use that RIDE. We started using RIDE after that for a variety of different changes. Like let's say we're going to procure a new tool. Somebody made a proposal, put RIDE at the top. I love that framework. I write about it a little bit. I've encouraged her to write, Pat Waters, to write about it. She is authoring a book right now. You can find her on LinkedIn.
That sounds a lot like the form of the advice process, which is, you see that mentioned in reinventing organizations, like whether it's the kind of like Toyota A3 or a change canvas or like RIDE is another one where you're deliberately seeking out as much feedback as you can and make sure that anybody who's impacted gets involved on the decision before making the decision. And it kind of like you replace the one official hierarchy with all the unofficial ones that are existing, basically. So it's kind of a neat variation of that.
I think it's nice to get input when you can. Not all decisions will, you know, we won't get to give input to everything and we won't get to be the decision makers on everything. Sometimes, especially these large scale changes that we see that get rolled out, we don't get to participate in that. So I acknowledge those types of changes as well in the work that I do, because sometimes you can't decide. You're not going to be involved. You're not going to be included. It might feel really bad. And there's another framework that I really like for helping people cope with changes, especially ones that maybe they didn't expect. The book Managing Transitions by William Bridges. He's written a lot of different books about transitions. And, you know, there's an ending, a neutral zone, and a new beginning. So you'll have a change.
Zone.
Yeah. So
we've got some Star Trek terminology leaking.
Neutral zone. Is that a Star Trek term?
Well, I mean, considering you've been known as the Donna Troy of agile coaches, I thought you would recognize the other Star Trek. So I had to throw that Donna Troy comment in, the one that John Cutler made in your foreword, because I thought that was.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That. Is she like the therapist type or something? Like I've been.
She's the psychology empath.
Right.
Anyway, anyone who's a Star Trek fan will see the
Trekkies get it. Yeah. I've been also compared to Wendy from Billions, that series as well, which is kind of funny.
Oh, I'm too much of a nerd. I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
That doesn't have laser guns.
It's actually a great series that came out a few years ago about, I don't know this. I'm looking over here because I have the Bridges books on my bookshelf. But yeah, you go through an ending, neutral zone. You're not quite sure. Some people are into the new future. Maybe they got a promotion maybe the company went through a big change. Some people gain things and some people lose things. And it's horrible when we lose things, money, status, information. And then we're like, what is this future going to be like? We're in this neutral zone. And finally, we accept it in the end. We're in this new beginning. Some people jump into that new beginning, I think, really quickly. Maybe they got more money. Maybe they got a promotion. All this stuff. People gain things. People lose things. And I think it helps. This is to one of your questions earlier, like how do we help people when they're going through lots of changes? I think just normalizing the Bridges model of transition is a helpful thing. I like that one at least.
You talk a lot about patterns in your book, and you have kind of like patterns of teaming and sort of these anti-patterns. There's probably too many to cover in this session, but are there any ones that you feel like are particularly apt, you know, that kind of come to mind, either like good patterns or anti-patterns you really want to watch out for that you think are can be really thorny?
Yeah. So I guess in brief, the patterns are one by one. Someone joins your company, someone leaves your company, grow and split. Your team might grow bigger and split into two or more teams. Sometimes teams merge together and join efforts and become a larger team. Isolation, sometimes you form a team off to the side, give people process freedom, maybe they work on a new product. And then switching to alleviate stagnation, maybe someone switches to a different team to learn something new or to work with different people. So I think, those are like the five patterns that emerged when I was writing my book, when I was interviewing people around the world and reflecting on my experience. And I call them like base patterns because I think you can combine them and use them in different ways if you're deliberately trying to change your teams. But there are also, you know, look, reteaming is hard. Like, it's really easy to screw this up. You are dealing with that human layer and dealing with the personalities and the people. And when they gain things, they're happy. When they lose things, they're not happy. And it can be very challenging, especially for caring teammates, for managers, for others.
Especially if the team has less input than, which, as you said, sometimes that needs to happen where the org, it's got to shift businesses or they've got to transition to something else. They've got to face starve off bankruptcy in some cases. And, you know, even in big organizations, you get like internal bankruptcy, I'll call it. It's maybe not the whole company going down, but the division or the line of business or the funding of the program goes away. So you've talked about self-selection, but you've also talked about a lot of sort of things that organizations can do to kind of master this reteaming. What are some of those things, like, you know, to help them master some of the more negative consequences? You've talked about it a bit, but is there anything else, other advice you could give?
It's almost like some Kanban type approaches. Kind of start where you are, agree to pursue incremental improvement, and make your policies explicit, and so forth.
You're talking to a Kanban nerd here.
Okay. So it's like, hey, all right. Amazing. I was pulling that from way back in my brain. But it's kind of like that. You know, we're start where you are. You're working at a company. Some things are working, some things aren't working. And as you go through time, you encounter challenges. And when you encounter challenges, it's nice to get together and talk about them and how are we going to approach this? There's usually multiple solutions, option A, option B, option C. Each one has pros and cons, including people who are closest to the challenge or who are living it day to day is usually helpful for coming up with the next design to use to move forward. So I think acknowledging that, you know, this isn't about going in there, bull in a china shop, breaking things and changing it from the current state to a future state immediately. Things take time. So doing small experiments is a helpful thing. Like trying out, if you think of a program that might benefit everyone in your, you know, 1,000-person organization, you can try it out first with a smaller group, see what you learn, and then have a gradual rollout. You know, so you can experiment and learn. You can acknowledge that time will bring you changes. Expecting change is a helpful thing to do. Including people in decision-making is something that we've also talked about. Having a problem-posing approach is, again, really helpful. If you're making change just for the sake of change, people aren't going to trust you and they're going to think you're, you know, doing things a little oddly. You need to anchor to the reality of a problem you're trying to solve. So I think it helps to be guided by that. Reflecting and learning about what happened is also a helpful thing. You can make this, like, you can make reteaming type events like a program. When you encounter them, you're going to learn along the way, reflect. If you have to do it again later, what do you learn? When I was at AppFolio, software for property management companies, I was there as the 10th employee and from one team to 25 teams. We grew a lot during the time I was there. We used to make checklists because the team changes would happen so much that whenever a team would change, we would change their desk. We would change, they would have to get the meeting invites, the Slack group, you know, like we had a regular checklist that we developed because the thing happened all the time. So, you know, we're building the software and we're delivering it and delighting our customers, but then we do have this people layer. We're building the company of people that are doing the work at the same time that we're building our products. So we can apply some of the same things like retrospectives at that kind of human organizational level. So I think that's also helpful.
Yeah, I love to recommend actually people have sort of when they do their planning cadence, they consider it a reorganizing cadence too. You know, because new outcomes come in, new problems are coming in. And one of the things you want to say is how do we organize towards those outcomes and those problems? And I love this this practical examples you have of bringing as many, sometimes it's a few, but sometimes it's as many people as you can into that process to kind of lower the friction of, it's much better if people say, oh, wait a minute, these are the outcomes, these are the things, maybe we're not organized, we should kind of pick up and move versus five people kind of behind the curtains kind of making all the decisions. So I really like these practical examples that you're bringing to this.
I think also like if you're working in an environment and you know, you might, there's somebody behind the curtain always dictating the shots. Like, it just doesn't feel good. So, you know, after we like to choose, or at least have some kind of choice in our surroundings.
In our destiny, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
What are some things that you've been up to currently, and what's next for Heidi? Like, what are some exciting things that you want to share with our listeners?
Yeah. So I do consult. I've been working at this startup in Santa Barbara, and that's been very exciting because I've been able to get back to some of my roots with interaction design and product development. So I'm excited about that. And it's nice to be a part of this team. And so I've also quietly been writing a book called How to Change Your Teams. And it's on LeanPub right now. I haven't told many people about it, actually.
So that's How to Change Your Teams, and it's on LeanPub.
It's okay. On LeanPub, yeah. So I'm almost finished with it. People have asked me, how do I do reteaming? How do I do this? Like, what do I do? And I've been getting that question for years. And, you know, to be honest, I wrote that book, and it's more of a descriptive piece. This is how teams change. I did this research. I noticed, this is a thing. And this book proves a point that teams change. Here's how they change. It wasn't, and maybe I do have some how-to things in there. There's activities.
You've got some good how-to stuff in there. At least I thought you did.
I guess there is some how-to stuff, but I never really stepped back. And like, if I was going to share how to do this deliberately, what would I say?
Like, how to facilitate it or support it, or what to do before and afterwards and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So I've written this short guide called How to Change Your Teams. So I've got that going on. I'm trying to finish that up, working at this startup, and I do speaking.
And you're still consulting, and if people want your help, they could reach you, I assume, is it HeidiHelfland.com?
Yep, HeidiHelfland.com. You can reach out to me there, connect on LinkedIn.
Reach out on LinkedIn.
Yeah, any of that's fine.
If you hear that, if you need help on some reteaming, Heidi's always available, which is good to hear. Heidi, thank you so much. This has been an amazing conversation. Your work was a big influence. It's kind of funny, when I was writing my book, I had a whole lot of reteaming stuff, but it's all based on you kind of are trying to reorganize your company and your organization. And there's a lot of tactical, how do you know when teams need to happen by looking at a Kanban board, or how do you know when things need to change? Whereas what you did is really hit the human side of it, and the things to watch out for and the things to look at, which I just love. It's an amazing book, and it's been a big influence on how I try to approach things. So
thank you very much.
Take care, and thanks again for coming on board. I really enjoyed this. It's great.
Thanks again for joining me on Whiplash Agile. Make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss a single episode. If you want to connect with me, join me on LinkedIn or Twitter/X. And if you like what you hear, or especially if you don't like what you hear, get in touch with me directly at agilebydesign.com.